Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Michael Roberts. I'm Executive Director of Penn American Center, and I want to welcome you all and thank you for coming out this afternoon for this fifth and final day of what I think has been a remarkable extravaganza of international literature. We've had 170 writers from 51 countries, 82 events, more than three dozen languages represented, I think once again giving the lie to the myth that Americans are not interested in international literature. I just want to tell you that there are several more programs following this one, including the Arthur Miller Freedom to Write lecture tonight with Umberto Eco, followed by a conversation with Adam Gopnik. That'll be at the Cooper Union, so please join us if you have time. And especially like to thank the New York Public Library. Again, we're delighted that they've joined us as co-sponsors of World Voices for the fourth straight year. This festival, as everything else that Penn does, supports the proposition, as Norman Mailer said more than 21 years ago in this building, that writers speak across national boundaries more gracefully and instinctively than governments. But sometimes writers have to speak directly to governments, particularly when they defy international law and their own commitments by denying their citizens the vital free expression that literature and, in fact, democracy itself depends on. So the empty chair that you see on the stage is a reminder that the silencing of writers in one country robs the entire world of their voices. In this Olympic year, and I know you've heard this before, but it bears repeating, Penn is conducting an international campaign to win the release of more than three dozen writers and journalists now in prison in the People's Republic of China before the Olympic Games open in Beijing just barely 3 months from now. That's about 39 people, so imagine the first three rows here all in jail today as far as we know. So at this event, we particularly want to remember Zhang Yijun, who is a poet, professor, and freelance journalist, who was arrested on December 3rd, 2004 in connection with 63 articles that he had written for foreign-based publications and websites. Zhang was convicted of incitement to subversion of state power, it's always the same charge, on July 21st, 2005, and sentenced to 7 years in prison and 3 years deprivation of political rights. He's currently being held in Jinzhou Prison in Jinzhou City, Liaoning Province, where he's suffering from diabetes. So please join Penn's efforts to win the release of Zhang Yijun and all the writers and journalists currently in prison in China. Sign the petition at the Penn table outside the event. We've delivered copies of it with more than 3,000 signatures to the UN delegation from the PRC earlier this week, and they did not answer the door, but we still think they got the message. I just want to say that there will be question and answer at the end of this session and, I believe, a book signing outside afterwards. Daniel Kelmann was born in 1975 in Munich, the son of parents involved in film and theater. He attended a Jesuit college in Vienna and traveled widely and has won several awards for previous novels and short stories, most recently the 2005 Candide Award. His work has been translated into more than 20 languages, and his latest novel, Measuring the World, spent more than a year on the German bestseller list, selling more than 750,000 copies, which in this country, unfortunately, is a level that's, as somebody said, only achieved by boy wizards and conspiratorial Catholic friars. And Jeffrey Eugenides is the author of The Virgin Suicides, which was adapted into a film in 1999 by Sofia Coppola, and also Middlesex, which won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. He recently edited My Mistress's Sparrow is Dead, Great Love Stories from Chekhov to Monroe, which was published in January of this year. He's been on the faculty of Princeton University's program in creative writing since the fall of 2007. Welcome, please, Daniel Kelmann and Jeffrey Eugenides.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Daniel and I met last December, I think, on a panel in which we were the victims of an overzealous moderator. and so, consequently, we're not able to speak or get to know each other until after the event was over. But then I did have the pleasure of meeting Daniel, and when this event was talked about, we decided we would like to try to go without the net and serve as our own moderators and just have a conversation and try to have a conversation that would maybe resemble a bit more just two writers talking about writing. And so we've actually prepared some questions, very high-minded literary questions that were drawn up on the back of cocktail napkins at the Roger Smith Hotel and then typed up. So what we're going to hope to do is alternate in our questions with me beginning and take it from there, and then we'll have some question and answer period after our talk. Anything you want to add to that?
Not right now.
Okay. No. So here we go. This is beginning with a quote from Daniel's wonderful novel, Measuring the World. And the quote goes like this: "It must be a foolish undertaking for an author, as was becoming fashionable these days, to choose some already distant past for his setting." This quotation from Measuring the World strikes me as a possible jumping off point for a discussion of historical novels in general and your own novel in particular. What I'm interested in here is the unease the quotation betrays. You seem to be telling the reader in a sly manner that the entire project of writing historical novels is suspect, even though this thought issues from a character in a historical novel. I'd wager that you and I would both agree that the historical novel as a genre is a fraudulent one. That is, the knowingness of most historical novels, the presumptuousness of any author who claims to be in total possession of a truth that can't be fully known or verified, right down to the particulars of weather on a certain day in 1821, these are stumbling blocks for any writer alert to the dishonesty of generic formulas. It seems to me that the way the thing is handled, or the way you handle it, is through tone. As the quotation above demonstrates, Measuring the World possesses a playful, at times postmodern tone. The reader is aware of the author here being very mischievous, and this slyness disinfects the novel of the moldiness common to most historical novels. At the same time, Measuring the World is an extremely gripping, moving novel, not at all a literary game, but involving, informative. It provides the pleasures of historical fiction without succumbing to the genre's falseness. My question, I'm getting to my question, is this: given the fraudulence of most historical novels, how did you succeed in writing such a marvelous and completely unfraudulent one? Did the genre initially repel or attract you, and what were the things you wanted to avoid?
Yes, I hope you can hear me well. I had a slight accident before with my microphone, but so tell me if you don't hear me, but it seems to work. Yes, I had a deep suspicion of the historical novel as a cheap and fraudulent and, as a genre, very much occupied by trivial literature. Mm-hmm. And I asked myself as an experiment, how can you deal with that? How can you write a novel that's set in the past, but that is not trivial? And that is not trivial in this way, this hundreds of thousands books published each year in paperback with knights and people with daggers on the cover are fraudulent and cheap and slightly ridiculous. And as you say, it is the tone. I thought about it a long time, and I thought about it especially: why do novels seem phony the moment we read a sentence like "This battle will be ours," mm-hmm. said Napoleon, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, if you read Eric Hobsbawm, "The Age of Revolutions," mm-hmm. It's about the same people yeah. you read about all the time in historical novels, and it's not ridiculous at all.
Except Napoleon said, "This battle will be mine."
That's true. That's true. And it's the tone. Serious historical writing has this distanced tone of never getting too close to characters, never putting in, of course, too many descriptions,
right.
And never using direct speech, of course, because if there was no recording device present, you have no idea what these people might have said. And all these technical means of writing very serious, non-fictional historical science, mm-hmm. I used to write a novel, which of course is it doesn't really make sense, and that's what it was all about, mm-hmm. because you get is this very, very serious tone, and at the same time I relate things that are not at all serious. And I said it a few times, but it was really what I had in mind as a vision when I worked on this. I wanted the novel to sound, to have the sound of a very serious historian who had suddenly gone mad, but still goes on doing his job and writing.
You do use indirect speech quite a bit in it, so you're not...
Yes, and even more in the German.
Really?
Yes, in the German it's nearly all in indirect speech. English doesn't have this very particular, very strange grammatical forms for indirect speech, mm-hmm. that I use in German. So that was another experiment for me in German, to use so much indirect speech.
What's the form in German? Is it a different... goes into a different case or something?
It goes into a different case.
I didn't get to that lesson.
Jeff is actually quite good German.
Working on indirect speech.
That's something I think you would arrive during the third year of learning German. And most German speakers are quite insecure about these clauses because they never use them. And I was a bit insecure about them too. It's quite impossible to write a whole novel in this with using them all the time without making a few mistakes. But, well, what are editors for? But at the beginning, this experiment to always use these forms of indirect speech that are slightly old-fashioned, slightly out of date, mm-hmm. quite, and a little bit over formal, for events and things happening, mm-hmm. that just do not fit,
right.
to this formal way of telling them. It took me some time to gain confidence. At the beginning, I thought this will turn out to be completely unreadable. But then I gained confidence and had more and more fun doing it.
It's a good way to get to avoid that problem. I mean, the problem that you have when you're writing a historical novel and you have dialogue is the same as in a movie where people are playing Germans, they're speaking English, but they're using a German accent, right? And it's supposed to give this verisimilitude to it. And if you think about it for a moment, it's absolutely ridiculous. And sometimes when I would write a bit of dialogue and pretend that it was being spoken in 1920, I'd have that same feeling. So to do it in indirect discourse that way, you avoid that problem.
I think it's the only way to do it, and that's why I don't think a good movie can be made out of the novel. They are trying it now to make a movie out of it, but I said I'll stay away from that because mm-hmm. I don't think that it can be done. But you have some experiences of movies made out of novels which are not movie-like.
My advice is you should stay away from it, but I bet they could make a good movie.
I'm not sure about a good movie, but I will definitely stay away.
We got that settled.
Yeah. Now my first question. It's pretty much the same thing in a way. Both your novels seem to be from a formal aspect about perspective, about adopting a seemingly impossible point of view and then to narrate the story using this point of view. I think there is a certain hilarity in both your books that just comes from having pulled it off. This is clear in The Virgin Suicides with its choir of narrators and its we perspective. And I must admit, when I started reading it, I couldn't believe that you could really do that, that you would be able to tell the whole story in this collective voice without ever stepping out of it. So my question, when you started working on The Virgin Suicides, were you already sure that you would be able to keep this voice for the whole book? Did you have already a clear concept of this collective voice, this choir, when you started, or did you just find it in the act of writing?
You're right about your assumption that I like the idea of an impossible narrator. it's something that literature can do that journalism cannot do, is to have a narrator that's either whose origin is undisclosed, or a narrator like in The Virgin Suicides, where it's a choral narrator. It's not just one person. So I like that. It has some of the qualities of religious texts, where a voice mm-hmm. is issuing from God or from on high, and you don't exactly know where it's coming from, but it's a voice of great import, and it gets your attention. So I was thinking of those things. In terms of the specifics of writing the narration of The Virgin Suicides, at first I had this, you know, I was trying to tell it from the entire town's point of view, from young people through older people. And I also had an eye narrator who stepped out in the early drafts mm-hmm. to, say, sort of take over the job of narrating the novel. But as I worked on it, I realized I didn't need the eye, that it was working fine with this wee voice. So I just cut it out. And I also noticed that most of the heat of the narration was coming from the adolescent boys when they were mm-hmm. Talking about it. So I narrowed the focus inches to the teenage boys. So this happened in the early drafts. And I don't know if you remember the old Talk of the Town pieces in The New Yorker, where it was always we, kind of royal we. I grew up with those, and I liked the idea of having a kind of cracked New Yorker we narrator narrating this story about this town. So it was that. I subsequently realized that I was influenced by Faulkner's A Rose for Emily, which is also told in a wee voice. I read that obviously in high school. It was knocking around in my brain somewhere. So when I tried to do it, I wasn't aware that was the influence. So I think it probably was. Mm-hmm. But it was a matter of trial and error and seeing what the effects were and then responding to those.
But you didn't think of Greek tragedy and the
No,
choir.
I never thought about Greek tragedy.
I'm sure you have been asked that a few times.
If my name was, you know, Abramovitz, yes. I don't think I would get this. I get it all the time, the Greek choral
sure,
narrator.
Sure.
You know, all the time. But I don't know, maybe it's genetic. It's deep in my soul. I don't know. Okay. Here comes another quote, Daniel. "That man," he said, "impressive, but crazy too. As if truth was something you found out there and not here, or as if you could run away from yourself." This is Gauss thinking about Humboldt after reading about Humboldt's departure for the Orinoco. This is echoed later in the book, very near the end, when Humboldt thinks about Gauss, and Humboldt thinks this: "But as the first suburbs of Berlin flew past, and Humboldt imagined Gauss at that very moment, staring through his telescope at heavenly bodies, whose paths he could sum up in simple formulas, all of a sudden he could no longer have said which of them had traveled afar and which of them had always stayed at home." This is a recurring question in your novel. Who travels further, the explorer or the mathematician? Both your heroes, and here the term really does apply, Humboldt and Gauss are both true heroes, larger than life and endowed with superhuman abilities. Both are engaged in a noble mission to literally measure the world. Humboldt wants to measure every hill, mountain, and cave. Gauss, prime numbers, and the heavens. Despite the ferocity and intelligence they bring to their pursuits, a final reckoning eludes them. The book seems to be about the human desire to measure the immeasurable. If this is wrong, please correct me. But I'm curious to know what your initial interest was in Humboldt and Gauss. Did you see them as opposites or spiritual brothers?
As very opposite spiritual brothers, they are united in this, as you said, this noble enterprise of measuring the world, of understanding the world, of really, and that's pretty much what science is. Science is not working on better schemes to build cars. But it is this idea that I want to understand everything, and I won't accept anything on faith or dogma or just on belief. I want to understand it, and I will not stop before I understand. And I think this is a very noble and endeavor. At the same time, of course, I use this kind of psychology the psychological mindset of the scientist for, well, some comedy and some comic effects in the book. And they are spiritually very much alike in that they share this urge to understand. And they're completely different in pretty much everything else. One stays at home, one goes everywhere. And the one who goes everywhere is very unfree person that in some way never leaves Germany, though he always wants to run away from Germany and his family. And so in some way, I like to think that it's a book about not only about the two ways of doing science that wouldn't be, interest me that much to write a novel about empiricism and rationalism. I think it's a book about the two basic modes of freedom, the freedom to move and the freedom to think. And this is a very old human question, the question who is more free, the person who really has no mind, no bounds in his or her mind, or the person who gets to get everywhere.
But you didn't have a victor in your mind after writing it.
Well, I didn't want to have a victor in my mind. I thought I would maintain perfect equilibrium, but looking on the book now and also from hearing what how readers react to it, I think that Gauss is the victor in my book.
Yeah. Well, Gauss is the one with the Sitzfleisch, right?
He is, yes.
That's what a writer needs.
Yes, of course, like us. And I think it comes from being a writer that I preferred Gauss, and that Gauss, though he's the much less nice and friendly person, he behaves quite horribly.
Explain what Sitzfleisch is for anyone who doesn't.
Yeah,
it's a very good German word.
Sitzfleisch is a very good German word that basically means the muscles at the bottom.
Yes.
So the ability to sit for a long time without...
In a hard chair.
Yes, yes. Without feeling too uneasy. So, yes, that's what you need to write novels. I think you don't necessarily need to write poems, but as novelists, we all have that. And so I tend to identify, if we want it or not, more with the person who stays at home and travels in the mind than with the person who travels everywhere. I mean, if an explorer would have written the book, it might have turned out different. Now for Middlesex, I have a theory I would like to bother you with. I think what got you interested in the whole idea first was not as much the psychological level of the story, the whole gender topic. I think it was your interest in seemingly impossible narrative perspectives. Well, there are two points to it. First, everybody who attends a creative writing course, I think, will learn that if you have a personal narrator, a me in the story, you cannot relate events that this narrator hasn't been a witness of. But this is exactly what you do for about the first half of the book. It's forbidden, it's impossible, you do it, and it works. How did you find the courage for this? And didn't you have, while you were working, didn't you have the frightening image of all the angry creative writing teachers in mind?
<Yeah. laughs> that I now am myself. I wish it had happened the way you said, because I would have written the book more easily if I knew how to attack it from the beginning. But contrary to your theory, I actually was initially interested in the idea, just the idea of writing a book from the point of an intersex person, someone who had been both sexes.
It's always like that with theories.
Yeah. I mean, and I got the idea.
There goes my theory.
Different reasons, you know, from reading Ovid in high school. I remember I've told this story often, but we were translating the bit, the argument that Zeus and Hera have about who has a better time in bed, men or women. And Zeus says that women do, and Hera says that men do. And they argue about it back and forth, and they finally say, well, who should we ask? And they say, let's ask Tiresias, because he's been both. And then Tiresias comes in, and he says, if the pleasures of love be as 10, then 3 times 3 belong to women, the rest belongs to man, which sounded kind of bleak to a 15-year-old boy at that time. But I do remember even then, like, what an amazing character this guy was, that he knew more than anybody else. So it was that idea of trying to have such a character that was the kernel for writing the book, because a novelist wants to have omniscience, total omniscience, Tolstoyan omniscience, Shakespearean omniscience. So a hermaphrodite would possess a greater measure of that. So then I tried to write it, but as with The Virgin Suicides, I ran into all these problems of being able to narrate it. When I was doing it at first, it was just a first-person narrator, and it worked reasonably well if he was writing about his own life, but when the book became a book about a gene, a mutated gene that passed down through generations, it then had to deal with history. And once that's when I ended up in the realm of the historical novel, which I hadn't foreseen that I would, and that's when I started to realize that I didn't like historical novels and I couldn't write one, and everything I wrote felt false to me. So I had to find a way to animate the characters who lived before my narrator lived. And the only way to do that was to break the rule of a first-person narrator. So I endowed my narrator with third-person omniscience, even though he's just a person. He's not magical, and he doesn't have ESP or anything like that. How I satisfied it to myself is, I think any mode of narration should tell you about the character speaking. And it seemed to me that if you were a person who inherited a genetic mutation, your need to understand how this happened to you and where it came from would be so great that you might sort of break the boundaries of ego in an imaginative attempt to explain your life. So he's pretty clear, Cal Stefanides, the narrator, is pretty clear with the reader that he doesn't know everything that happened in 1922, but he knows as best he can, and he's going to try to tell the truth. He might ornament it at times, but there's a kind of emotional need for him to have this narration, and that's what satisfied me as a writer. If the voice told you about the character, then it seemed like a novelistic voice, and I did think about my teachers, and I knew they would. Chastise me if I couldn't pull it off. So, fortunately, they never read your books. Your old teachers.
That helps. That is true.
One of the most stunning things in the book is your portrait of Gauss, the way you describe the working of an incomparable mind sentenced to live among lesser minds. The scene on his wedding night, when Gauss notices the rising moon, and is, quote, ashamed to realize that in this very moment he suddenly understood how to make approximate corrections in mismeasurements of the trajectories of the planets. All this is marvelous. He's in bed with his bride, and he looks out the window and sees the moon, and suddenly, aha, he has to get out of the bed, jot down a formula, and get quickly back. Geniuses are, by definition, unknowable, and yet you make us know Gauss. Now, I assume you are not as smart as Gauss. That being the case,
you can safely assume that.
Yeah. Well, according to your book, he teaches himself to read at the age of 3 in about 3 hours by staring at a page of print, which is rather smart. That being the case, how did you do it? In other words, how smart are you? How much math and physics do you know? What was your Jesuit university like? And lastly, can I enroll?
It was not a Jesuit university. It was just a Jesuit school, and we weren't even taught by Jesuits. It was just Jesuit-run place. But all the Jesuits had left to Southern America when I came there to fight their political fights. Uh-huh. And we were stuck with totally normal state-employed teachers. But it still sounds very good, the thing about the Jesuit school. of course, it was horribly difficult to cope with the maths of Gauss. I'm not a mathematician. I'm not a scientist by training.
But are you pretty proficient at math compared to...
Actually, no. I was quite good at school in it, but that's not really enough to deal with this higher mathematics. And I was, of course, this was a reason for me to hesitate whether I should try to write this novel or not. And I also had the feeling that I cannot just say that Gauss is a great mathematician and then the math never comes up in the book. It often happens, yeah. Especially in movies. It's often handled yeah. like that, but I think you cannot do that. I had the feeling that it's not necessary that the reader learns anything about maths in a novel. That's not the purpose of a novel, and I'm not the one who could teach it, but I should know about it. Mm-hmm. And I have to find ways to put it in a novel so that the reader has the feeling that it's there, although he or she isn't really bothered with it. So I had to sit at home with books, and it was like having to go to school again, mm-hmm. like preparing for a math exam. Really writing numbers and trying to figure out what he means, and there are some quite good introductions into the math of Gauss, mm-hmm. And I tried to work my way through this, and I didn't reach the end, but I didn't come that far. But I learned something, yeah. It was quite interesting and very horrible to deal with that. And I tried to put it in the book in scenes like that. He's always surrounded by math. He thinks yeah. in math. He thinks in mathematical terms. It's just his way of reacting towards the world. He never talks much about math. There are no essay parts of the book that are about math. Yeah. I mean, this would be the Umberto Eco way to handle it, and I didn't really want to do it like right. that.
He is in the back row, though, so just in case you
I have a huge, huge admiration for Umberto Eco, but I thought this is not the kind of book I want to write. A huge postmodern novel with a lot of non-novelistic yeah. parts of in it. This was exactly what I did not want to
do. But you do it in ways that allows the reader to feel what it might be like to be that smart. I mean, at first, Gauss,
yes.
he just doesn't understand why everyone speaks so
yes.
slowly.
That's
because his mind is so fast, he can't believe yeah. the pauses people make. And as he gets older and his mind starts to
yeah.
starts to decay a little bit, he sees the pauses are not quite as long as they used to be.
That was the trick I used, because I had to find a way to put the reader into the mind of a singularly intelligent person.
Yeah.
He might well be one of the 10 most intelligent
right.
people who ever lived. And the technical way I found to do this is, we all know this experience when from some situations in life when we have to explain something to a person that is really not
yes.
willing or yes. able to follow. I'm not asking you whether how
yeah.
often it comes up in your professional
yes.
experience as a teacher. No, it
yeah.
happens again
right.
and again
yeah.
in life in different situations.
Yeah.
It's a very sad and unsettling mm-hmm. experience. It makes you angry and sad at the same time, and but it doesn't happen that
yeah.
often to normal people, and to God. I just put Gauss in the situation that it happens to him whenever he talks to anybody.
Right.
And his deep melancholy comes from there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this was my technical way of putting
yeah.
the reader into this into this mind that is
yeah.
of course quicker than mine and the reader's and everybody's.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. When I'm writing a character whose experiences I have not shared, what I try to find is one little bit of his experience that I have shared
mm-hmm.
and then extrapolate
mm-hmm.
it. So I understand
mm-hmm.
why you would do that. The other amazing point is when he's working on his Gauss is working on his major book, and he gets so absorbed in it that suddenly when he's walking on the street, he just moves out of the way at some point, and a brick falls and almost hits him. It's almost as though he's entered a different
yes.
realm of perception
yeah.
by dint of his
yeah.
intellectual effort. Which was another way I really felt what it might be like. For a moment, I was Gauss.
I also wanted, I also did this because I did not want to go for that cliche of the nutty professor and the mathematician who doesn't see reality, who isn't able to react.
What about the war,
reality.
Though? He doesn't notice the war is going on.
No, he doesn't care. Yeah. But okay, that's a bit of a nutty professor, I admit that. But still, he's quite alert to the things that really happen around him. And I think it is a cliche, and I think it's not true. If you talk to mathematicians, you find out that they're quite aware, that they have a dry sense of humor, that they have a keen perception. They are very often rather cold people, but they are not the way the cliche would want them to be. And I think it is true that a deep concentration doesn't really remove you from reality, it really puts you into reality. Yeah. What removes you from reality is an iPod.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of presuppositions about mathematicians. I went to a dinner party at Princeton and I was seated next to some earth-shaking mathematician and I asked him if he played chess and was he good at chess. I assumed he's apparently terrible at chess. I thought those two things would go together, but they don't.
Yeah.
So who knows? Is it your turn? Okay.
I think it's my turn, yeah. I am. I have to ask you about that. I'm a huge admirer of Gabriel García Márquez, and, well, who isn't? I think he's not only the best novelist of our time, I think he operates on a level different from all the others. I think you could say Flaubert, James, and Márquez, and it doesn't sound odd. Would you agree? And I'm asking this because I think that Márquez is quite present in your work. For me, the collective narrator of The Virgin Suicides has echoes of The Autumn of the Patriarch. And the way Middlesex deals with a family's quasi-mythological past, influencing the present, reminds me of course, 100 Years of Solitude. What did and does Márquez mean to you?
You're right. I love his work and influenced by him. The Virgin Suicides is the book that's influenced by García Márquez, but it's probably a chronicle of a death foretold that I think of because of the kind of detective story that goes on without finding out the answer and the way they go around the town asking everyone. So that's what I got from Márquez. But I plead entirely guilty on that point. That's a good thing to be guilty about. I have a García Márquez question for you. I'd like to ask you about your feelings about magical realism. Critics sometimes call you a magic realist, but I didn't see that in Measuring the World at all. The most magical events that happen in the book literally happen in García Márquez territory when Humboldt's in South America. But they are not truly magical. They may be hallucinations or something else. As for myself, I don't consider myself a magic realist at all. I was always very careful never to break the laws of physics in Middlesex. With me, it's a matter of tone or atmosphere that makes people think I'm a magical realist. But I'm not, I don't think. What about you? How do you feel about magical realism and, more importantly, being labeled as a practitioner?
Generally, I think magical realism is one of the most important things happening in literature in the second half of the 20th century. It freed up literature from a lot of constraints. If you look at how literature looked when magic realism and the great South Americans came around with this very airtight French nouveau roman and all these very serious, engaged novels, politically engaged novels in Germany, and then you have this incredible opening up of South American literature and of magic realism, this self-conscious interweaving of dream and reality. So I think this is a wonderful thing that deeply moved me and also influenced me. Still, you cannot just pretend, that was my experience, that you're a South American and just use it because you like it.
Yeah.
And that would be a little bit, I think you can use it for technical purposes, for purposes of storytelling, but you have to have a really good reason. The reason cannot only be that it's around and that you like it. In the 80s, they did that sometimes. And for me, magical realism, well, it was a way to deal with Humboldt psychologically. Humboldt comes from German classicism, and he has this very clear and well-ordered worldview. And then he comes to a place that is the complete other of this worldview. And he reacts towards it by ignoring it all. And that's where I brought in magic realism. I let him see a sea monster, and he decides that he does not see a sea monster. He sees a flying saucer. It's also magic realism, but not a flying saucer. And he decides that there is no flying saucer. Mm-hmm. He is haunted by the ghost of his mother that keeps reproaching him for not being a good son, and he always has to shut this out of his perception. So it's, in a way, on the psychological level, I use it to characterize Humboldt, also for comic effects, of course. Mm-hmm. People who ignore something are always quite good as comic characters. Yeah. And also, for me, it was the way Humboldt was the way I could deal with this literature that was so important for me, that I could deal with it as a German. As a German writer, writing about Humboldt, coming from this background of classical German thought on Weimar classicism that is very that I know quite well from education and being brought up literarily in Germany, and then confronting also technically this completely other tradition that was not mine, but that influenced me so a lot and it meant so much to me. So for me personally, the character of Humboldt was a gift. I could personally use it to bring all these things together. I would not use magic realism, this Southern American form of magic realism, in just like that in another novel only because I like it. I would love to, but it's
Do you find any connection between the Kafka of the Metamorphosis and magical realism?
Yes, I think so. Marcus said that this was such a huge influence on him. I think the formula for magic realism is Kafka goes to Jokna-Patopa country. Mm-hmm. It's the synthesis
of Faulkner and Kafka. Yeah. So you don't have to feel so estranged as a European.
No, in some way we invented it. That's true. Oh, yes.
I'm just thinking of Kafka down in the south.
That would be a novel, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
That would be a novel. have to notice.
Yeah.
which we are already there. This leads me to the question of experiments. For me, The Virgin Suicides is one of the strangest and also, I must say, most beautiful experimental novels of the last decade. Maybe that's a European perspective, to be so obsessed with the idea that you cannot just go on spinning tales, but that any good novel has to be an experiment of some sort. But I think your books prove this point. Would you agree if I call your novels experimental literature?
I would be very happy if you called them experimental, because I always feel like a failed experimental writer in a sense. I began writing in college and in graduate school and trying to be very experimental. And I had a teacher, Gilbert Sorrentino, at Stanford, who had a big influence on me. And he was a man who had read everything and was incredibly fatigued with narration and storytelling. He thought there were no stories that could be told. So anytime I would engage in storytelling, I felt guilty, like I was backsliding. And at the same time, when I would try to be experimental, I mean, people think that the way you make something new or fresh is to maybe change the way your sentences work, or maybe not having any paragraph breaks, or a Georges Perec model where you write a novel without the vowel E in it or something like that. And I came along at a time where that didn't seem so exciting to me. And even worse, it wasn't really the kind of fiction that I was suited to write, because I did have some deep an abiding interest in writing plots and characters and having an emotional connection to the story. So I wanted to write that. And as I worked and attempted to write some books, I realized there were ways to try something new kind of between the lines, between the sentences. And that was by virtue of altering the narrative voice, as in The Virgin Suicides or Middlesex. And I tried to be experimental in a different way by combining different elements. Middlesex obviously combines a kind of mock epic or epic tradition of narration with a modern psychological novel, with an autobiographical novel. And I tried to put these different things together and maybe come up with something new. But it wasn't... I always felt that in a way that I'd given up being an experimental writer. So I'd be very happy if you'd call me one.
I don't think you've given it up. Only because the book sold well, that doesn't make it unexperimental.
No, that's just...
which many people think. Many people react that way towards books that sell well.
Some people say that actually if a book fails, they call it experimental. And if it actually works, then that's just a good novel. So I don't know if that's true. I'm going to go out on a limb here and risk a stereotype. In exploring the Orinoco River, Alexander von Humboldt began a national obsession with the mysteries of the jungle. Frequent references are made in your book to Aguirre, which can't but fail to make the reader think of Werner Herzog's film Aguirre, The Wrath of God. There were times in reading your account of Humboldt's adventures when the leaves of the jungle seemed to part to reveal the face of none other than Klaus Kinski. Forgive me for this. This is what readers do. I wonder if you can talk about the fascination that the jungle has exerted on the German imagination, and whether in choosing to chronicle Humboldt's life, you were engaging in a subtextual commentary on that long fascination. Since we are in the land of stereotypes already, I won't be shy to add a few more here. Does the jungle represent the other, the anti-Enlightenment, the anti-Germany? Does it function as a repository for everything Gauss is opposed to, that is, irrationality, mysticism, magic, etc.?
Yes, I can answer this very briefly by saying yes. It is a very interesting point, this German fascination with the jungle, because it's also the kind of vegetation, the kind of nature that's most remote one from what you have in Germany. And I think the historical Humboldt, he had, when you read his diaries, he had this incredible urge to get away from Germany, which is sad in a way because he took it with him. But this Humboldt set, the historical one and mine, they set out for the jungle because they are searching for the other, and then they are measuring it, and then they want to bring it down to the mm-hmm. to the Weimar and to the classical mm-hmm. and to the terms of clearness and logic, which is a noble and very ridiculous endeavor at mm-hmm. the same time. And yes, of course, Aguirre, of course, that movie influenced me in the way of looking at the jungle. Nobody looks at the jungle the same way after watching that. I think, by the way, Kinski is not such a great actor. He doesn't need to be. Yeah. With this face, you don't have to do anything. But if you actually do something, it's kind of outré always. But again, with this, he doesn't have to be good. He's just there. That's enough.
We were talking the other day about someone that had too much of a face. Maybe Kinski is one of those people.
Far too much. Yes, far too much. Okay. You published only two novels, as we know, and very few short stories. But as your novel, your stories, I think, can be considered models of the short form at its best. Somebody, I forgot who, maybe somebody knows, somebody said that the main difference between novels and short stories is that short stories actually can be perfect. I agree. Do you too?
I agree that short stories are incredibly difficult to write. And it's odd that in creative writing, when I studied it, and now as I teach it, that's how you begin to teach students. The first things students write are short stories. And yet it's the hardest form to get right. The only reason you have them do it is that because it's 10 or 12 pages, it works week to week in handing something into the workshop, but I find them incredibly difficult to do. A revelation to me happened when I was in graduate school and Larry McMurtry came for a visiting Writers' Week, and he said, you know, I think it's really a lot easier to write novels than stories. I used to try to write stories, but then I just wrote a novel, and I think it's a lot easier. And no one had ever said that to me before. And after he left, I started to think about writing novels. I found that I was much more suited to a longer form, because I have a hard time keeping something to 15 or 20 pages. I always have another idea to combine with the original impulse. So that just freed me up to try novels, and I'm much happier writing them. I'm still trying to learn short stories, and I write them. They take me very long time. I think novels can be perfect as well, mm-hmm. but short stories I think actually are technically more difficult. Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Not right now. No.
Yeah, your novel Eichen Kaminsky, which is coming out in
fall, yeah.
In fall,
in November,
in English translation, is a very different novel from Measuring the World. Do you see yourself as a writer who changes from book to book, who reinvents himself rather than purveying a certain tone or vision? Do you believe in the idea of an authentic voice, or is that a discredited romantic concept? For that matter, do you think authenticity is a matter of style or voice, or does it reside in other things, like your subject matter or narrative patterning?
That's a very good and very difficult question. I think if you have to work on stretching your abilities as a writer and to being able to do more and more and not to repeat yourself in a way that's too easy, because at the end, looking back on a writer's work, you always see that he or she has repeated him or herself a lot of times, and that basically a writer's work consists of the same topics, the same things, the same means of style coming back and back and back and back. So this is what happens in itself. And I think you, as a writer, have to be in a constant fight against this. Mm-hmm. I always try to do something completely different, using completely different means of style, different narrative perspectives, different stories. And then looking back, I realized most of the time it has a lot to do with what I did before. Right. And I think in that way. Novels are autobiographical. They are not autobiographical in the way that you just put the things you do into them, but they are autobiographical in the way that these themes that are there again and again and again without you actually planning them to be there, but they just sneak into it again, and also the kind of language you like to use, even when you try to sound different. If you're serious at it and if it works, you will sound different, but in your own voice. Mm-hmm. I think you don't have to be worried as a writer about losing your own voice, using your own topics, because they will come back anyway all the time. You have to fight to stretch your limitations. And there will be more recurrent topics, themes, even characters maybe than you think will be there when you set out to do it.
That's exactly my experience. Every time I write a novel, the difference to me with literary novelists and genre novelists is literary novelists change from book to book and are sort of reinventing the wheel each time they write a book. Mm-hmm. I was always plagued with the idea that you were supposed to find your voice as a young writer, because I never had no Hemingway voice issued out of me that was identifiably my own. And I felt bad about that for years. But I've written two different sorts of novels, and what I realize is that your obsessions are there in each book, and I do see the connection once I'm done with both of them, that they came from the same author, even though they're narrated in very different styles, completely different voices.
But you don't see them before? Do you? It's my experience.
No, before this is new territory.
This is I'm a completely new writer. And it is not true. It never is.
I mean, you can think of Adam Thurwell was at Princeton this week talking about this subject, and you think about Thomas Pynchon or somebody like that. And he has a book, Mason and Dixon, written in faux 18th century diction. And yet, if you read that, it's very Pynchon-esque. I mean, the voice is not the same as Gravity's Rainbow. It's not the same as Crying of Love 49. And yet, it's definitely only Pynchon could have written it. Yes. So something adheres to the writer, comes through from the writer's essence that is distinct from an actual literary voice. That really is where the personality resides.
Yes, yes. I think if you're serious about what you're doing in writing, if you really think, if you feel what the characters feel, if you think what they think, if you're in it, then authenticity. You don't have to worry about the authenticity or the authenticity of the voice. That comes in itself.
Okay, we're gonna give our final questions and then open it up to.
It's me now. Sorry, my turn. I think that might serve well as a last question. In my opinion, there are two kinds of writers: those who manage to publish a lot of books, and those who publish only a few but perfect ones. Those who publish a lot accept that there is a certain range of quality in their output, and this is certainly what those who publish only few books want to avoid. For example, in movies, we could say that it's Stanley Kubrick versus Robert Altman. I think you won't completely disagree if I put you on the Kubrick side. But are you content with the fact that you published only two but absolutely outstanding books? Or do you sometimes envy writers who manage to have this steady flow of publications? I'm asking this because I believe that it's in the nature of things that each of the two groups feels a deep wish to be like the other.
it's sort of like evolutionary strategies. I mean, you have mammals that have relatively few offspring and spend a lot of time caring for those offspring, and then you have trout that have maybe a few thousand eggs. And some of them will live and some of them will die. And I do confess that I am mammalian in this respect. Not entirely happy about it. I noticed you did say how many books I've published, and that is true. I've published two. I have lots of unfinished novels in my desk that no one will ever see, and I have many thousands of pages that no one will see. So I do sort of keep back a lot of things that I don't feel anyone needs to be bothered with. But I also, I also think why I must be actually more prolific than I seem to be. I work every day. Pages come out of me. And I think there might be a problem somewhere in my brain and that I'm going to always turn the corner and start being, Philip Roth-like very soon, and every 2 years a new book will appear, and I keep thinking this will happen to me. So I guess I do envy that idea, and I know my editor would be much more pleased if I was that way. At the same time, you can't but feel, people's time is limited. I never want to publish something unless I think it's something that I've worked on, and it's a readable thing. I never want to publish just because it's time to publish something. Mm-hmm. So I would persist in being a mammal, though I hope to be more fish-like in future. And I started, so that will end it right there.
Yes, right? Yes, okay. That's it.
So thanks very much. Thank you. They're going to bring up the lights, and we'll be happy to take questions from the audience, and we have about 15 minutes for questions. I guess they're going to hand people microphones, so wait till you get the mic.
Ms. Eugenides, I heard a story that you were working on The Virgin Suicide so much that you lost a job because of it. Is that true?
It's true that I was fired for writing The Virgin Suicides at work. I worked for the Academy of American Poets. I moved to New York and I got a job at the Academy of American Poets, which is a congenial job. I got to edit a newsletter for poets and write letters to James Merrill and John Ashbery. And my letters would be on the computer and I'd be writing them, and then I would have a toggle switch that I would press, which would then flip back to my novel, and I would start writing my novel. So I would be, "Dear Mr. Ashbery, we would like to invite you to read," and then I would toggle, "She came into the room." The moon was right. And this worked pretty well for a while until my boss happened to come up behind my chair while I was toggled on the wrong page, and he saw that I was writing my novel. So I was canned for writing on the job. And it was good because I probably would still be writing the book. but I realized I needed to finish it because I was unemployed. I had 6 months of unemployment compensation, and I did finish the book during that period and finally sold it.
But let me get this right. Yeah. The Association of American Poets fires people for writing poetic novels on the job?
Yes.
I think we should draw a manifesto against that.
Well, that wasn't in my job description. Someone in red? Yes.
I'm grateful for Middlesex. It's an amazing book. I wanted to ask about the craft, just the everyday craft of writing for us struggling writers. You know, could you describe your routines, your...
it's just all Sitzfleisch. It really is.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. It's really just writing every day and spending a huge amount of time at your desk. I don't think there's... And reading a lot, always, and especially when you're young. I mean, Daniel, one of the things that impresses me so much about him is that he's read and has instant recall of almost every novel ever published, except for just
most,
about.
Most of it I make up, but...
Well, maybe. But it's incredible how much he's read. And you know, my students ask me, what do I advise them to do? And I write as much as you can and read as much as you can. And it's very simple. I don't feel that there's any kind of inspiration that you can get, or living somewhere is good, or to have some kind of like stuffed badger that you rub now and then or anything like that. You just have to sit there. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, the same. Just the most important thing is to read. A wonderful advice. I think it worked for me in a way that Nabokov gave to his students was read poetry. I cannot write poetry, not at all. It's totally impossible for me. But still, I always found it very helpful mm-hmm. in dealing with the language, in feeling mm-hmm. How language can resonate, yeah. What all the possibilities in a sentence, in a phrase, in a word. It's usually much stronger in good poetry mm-hmm. than it is in prose. And so for writing prose, reading a lot of poetry in that language is, I think, very, very helpful.
In the back, a pink and...
I was very interested in your discussion about the sort of covert repetition and themes. I deal in the visual arts, and it's almost the opposite. Mm-hmm. You think of Joseph Albers and a lot of artists. When you're looking at those artists, you say you look for continuity and digging deeper and deeper and deeper. So I thought it was interesting that you came back to the fact that it's covert in your field rather than overt in other fields in terms of the continuity of themes. And why is that? You follow what I'm saying?
I do.
It's in my head, but I'm not sure I'm making it clear in the question.
I don't know if we were saying it was covert in our field. It's covert for us. There are certainly novelists yeah. who... have a kind of material, and they recognize it, and they continually mine it, and sometimes that actually is beneficial for writers. But I think for what Daniel and I were saying, I'll let him speak as well, is that we're not aware of anything being consistent. We think we're striking out wildly for new territory, and then we find out obviously we've dragged our baggage to the new place that we've gone.
Yes, it's like that. You can't really plan what idea and of story idea, I mean, gets you interested, grips you. It's people often ask you, well, they keep asking writers all the time, why did you write this book? Why did you write this story? And this is exactly the question you cannot answer. It is, you cannot really answer yourself why this story, this idea, you have this feeling I can do something with it. And with other wonderful ideas that people keep telling you, or maybe that you read about in the newspapers, germs for stories, or that you make up yourself, you feel this could be very good, but not for me. And you realize, looking back on the work from a few years' perspective, that there is something recurrent in the kind of ideas that that get you interested, and that get you interested is too weak a word, that really gets you that make you feel this spark of this sparkling feeling of I can do something with it, and I want to do something with it. And of course, in that way, it's always covert to yourself, and maybe obvious to everybody else, but maybe not. I think you do learn a lot about yourself if you read your own books, but maybe you don't want to learn all of that.
Yeah, and then you always get pigeonholed after you write a book, and you can tell how you've been pigeonholed by the books that you're sent to give an endorsement for. So first it was all teenage angst for me and suicide books, and then it was all sort of bizarre sexuality or historical novels. And by the time you get these things, you think, I didn't write about that, did I? It's not what I'm interested in. So you've moved on, and you don't realize it. You, yes, blue blazer. You. You don't want to.
Hi, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned the visualization of a movie when reading a book. And I was wondering if you feel that now, you know, growing up in the age of movies and television, if those mediums have had an influence on literature now, the way narratives are told and the way that you, you know, not necessarily you, but also just literature in general, the way narratives are told and descriptions are made. Do you think that film and television has an influence on that?
It has had a large influence, depending on the novel. There are certainly a lot of novels, and especially very popular novels, that read almost as like film scripts do. You can see the scenes, and they're almost not shot by shot, but scene by scene, seem to be a movie. Those aren't the kind of novels that that are my favorite novels, or that I want to write. But even in Middlesex, for instance, there's a lot of descriptions of cinematic techniques, and that maybe it was my revenge on the movies. Instead of having my book turned into a movie, I was turning movies back into words. So there are descriptions of time-elapsed film happening or film running in reverse, things like that. So obviously growing up in our time and seeing the world and learning in a way to construct narrative through movies, I've inherited all those things just naturally. I remember as a kid, we think new movies are self-explanatory, but I remember being a little kid and watching movies and not understanding what the narrative cues meant and trying to figure out, you know, what it meant if someone looked this way or some sort of suspicious glance. When you're really young, those things don't mean anything to you, and you learn the codes of movie making, and suddenly you're able to understand the narrative. So I'm sure I picked up all of those kinds of things as a kid, and I'm sure they come out in my writing. But I'm so I love novels so much more and language so much more that I always feel that my influences from other novelists by far trump anything that I've gotten through this from the cinema.
Yeah, I completely agree. We all grew up with movies and television so much that how could not have influenced us? It influences not only all the novels, it influences the way human beings react towards reality today. As you said, movies have codes of storytelling, and by now these codes have been incorporated into the way we all, from very early age on, react towards the world and experience the world. When the first movies were made, people didn't really understand the cut. There was somebody, something going on, and suddenly was something else going on, and therefore they needed to insert plates the next day with the plates. And we are absolutely used to that. Mm-hmm. Something happens, and then something else happens, and something else, and we see the connection. And
it's hard to remember, you know.
Yes. But how can you write a novel and not being influenced by the fact that we experience reality as something that works in cuts? And it's very basic, I think. It comes down to very, very basic levels of our understanding of our experiencing the world.
One of the things that I do like novels with plots is that I think it's not some kind of literary device. I think we all live with plots. When we're meeting someone, we tell them the things that have happened to us. We're wondering, if I do this, will this happen? Will it ruin me? And we're constantly thinking of our lives in terms of plot and consequence. It's not some sort of alien idea that's imposed by an outmoded culture. It's actually how we live. So, plot is really where the emotion is. Someone's pointing. Okay.
I had a question for Mr. Eugenides. In Middlesex, I was really struck by the shift in the narrator from the female to the male perspective, and I thought it very much for me retained the essence of the character while also switching from the female to the male perspective. Can you tell me a little bit about the process of that? Was that something that was difficult to switch between those two things?
I never did try to switch between a female voice and a male voice. The book is written by Cal Stefanides as a 41-year-old person living as a man. And though the novel kind of changes from the beginning to the end in its tone a little bit, it wasn't a question of changing the gender. I had a lot of problems coming up with the voice or feeling right about it, because I had to think, what is a hermaphroditic voice in a novel? What does that mean? Should it sound like a woman writing? Should it sound like a man writing? And that brought up the question, what does a woman sound like writing? And do women write differently than men? I'm not sure that they do. And there's a lot of theories about it. A lot of them French theories about it. Like jouissance was a big idea in the 70s that women wrote in a kind of circular manner, full of ecstasy and not really so logically, but a kind of embracing of reality. And then men were logical and rational and sort of staccato in their thoughts. I can think of so many counterexamples to those descriptions. Flannery O'Connor writes in that way, like a man, supposedly, and Virginia Woolf would be what they think of as a woman writing. I just don't know what the answer is, and it all seems very reductive to me. So I never wanted to try to write like a woman. I just wanted to come up with a voice that would be the voice of my narrator, and I decided, like anyone, he has his own voice. And I thought about him as a doctor would, and he has XY chromosomes. He has normal testosterone in utero, neonatally, and as an adult. So if it's true that these things affect our brain chemistry, and if it follows from that results in a kind of syntactic patterning that's identifiably male or female, my narrator would actually be fairly male. So at that point, I decided I could be him. I'm a male. He's got the same amount of testosterone, same chromosomes as me. I'll just write it in a voice that seems appropriate for this book, and I won't be worried every sentence. Is it sounding like a woman, or is it sounding like a man? Because, as I said, those categories seem to me to be arbitrary anyway. But it was something that bedeviled me and perplexed me for a long time before I arrived at the solution for that. Some in the front.
Hi. Both of your books have been translated and published in different places around the world, and I'm wondering what your experience has been of those publications in different countries.
We don't have the time anymore to tell a lot of stories about that. I'll just stick to two stories. First, I have no idea. My book was in Taiwan for 35 weeks on the national bestseller list, and I I look on this at these characters, these Chinese characters, and have no idea what they did to my rather language-related jokes in the book, and why they are reading this in such an alien form. But of course, I love the thought. And another nice experience was Jeff mentioned the scene with the wedding night, in which Gauss has a great finds an important theory, gets up, writes it down, and goes back to his bed. I always thought of that as quite a satisfying wedding night, because he goes back to the bed. Everything goes very well, and still he also additionally has found an important theory. But when the book was published in France,
I'll mention it.
That was mentioned in each of the reviews as a sign of that it was a book about two sexually seriously handicapped people. And yeah, so much for cultural differences. I couldn't quite agree, but who knows?
Well, I don't know. The wedding night of Sarkozy and Carla Bruni might have been something like that.
He certainly didn't find an important theory.
He got a call. Well, I will point out that Daniel is yet unmarried, I believe. So we'll see how you feel. Anyway, it was all lovely of you to come out on this afternoon, and we have to stop now, but thank you very much for coming.